Previously.tv Podcast Network.
I will kill you.
Okay. That's a good starting point.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 223 for the week of October 22, 2018. I am Optimal Kitchen Flow, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Rogue Vicodin, Sarah D. Bunting.
More like Narcant, am I right?
Oversized chicken shirt, Tara Ariano.
Shirt.
And almost a racist cashier, Sarah Baker.
On the Roseanne reboot and not in real life.
Welcome to another Extra Hot Great. Thank you for bearing with us while we took last week off. We are back to talk about the Conners, and we have with us a first-time guest, Sarah Baker. Hello, Sarah.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yay!
Yeah, Sarah B's in the house.
For the purposes of this podcast, to reduce user confusion, Sarah Bunting will be known as Buncey for the whole episode, which is her nickname in this
and
circle.
Beyond.
Indeed. Sarah Baker, you are an actor of note. If people recognize your voice, it may be because they've heard you on Bob's Burgers, disembodied from the rest of your physical form. Mm-hmm. But where are some of the other places that people may have seen you of late?
Of late, I am on television sometimes. I think people usually recognize me from either The Campaign, which was a movie several years ago with Zach Galifianakis, Will Ferrell, or from an episode of Louie that I did, even though we can't talk about it anymore because he ruined everything.
Cough. You were also on Go On.
Yeah, I was on Go On too with Matthew Perry.
And you were almost on the Roseanne reboot. Let's start from there since it was in your intro. Is there a story that you can tell about that?
Yeah. I mean, it's just I got an offer to play a part on Roseanne, you know, that last season. and it was a racist cashier at a grocery store. And I considered it because it was Roseanne. And at the time I was like, well, I never dreamed I would get to be on Roseanne. Mm-hmm. And now I'm glad I didn't do it. And
just to place that for our users, like, would that be a big stretch for you? Or are you pretty racist in real life? Or
No. That's why they called me. They were like, well, you're racist anyway. You want to come on? And I'm like, I don't know about the cashier part.
I was going to say, you don't know how to handle money at all. I know that about you. You just drop it on the floor and you're like, eh. And you walk away.
Irony is that she has a little Roseanne actually sticks up for this woman who's her neighbor, who's her Muslim neighbor, who the cashier, you know, says something really clever about going back to her camel or something like that.
Sure.
And Roseanne actually sticks up for this woman. But because it was the new Roseanne, she also at the end said, you know, the joke was she's got enough fertilizer in her garage to blow this whole town up or something.
Ugh, yeah.
Good times. I was like, I think I'll pass.
Well, so now this brings us to the Conners, which is Roseanne minus Roseanne, like Garfield without Garfield comic strips.
What if it was that actually? They actually just took old episodes of Roseanne and just rotoscoped her out of the episode. That would be amazing.
And so now I think this is a show you could proudly go on, maybe not to play a racist cashier, but I was nervous about it, and I was pleasantly surprised. After the first episode, I thought, well, that was kind of morose because it revolves around the death of the titular Roseanne. But I thought the second episode, which we got to see in a screener, was much stronger. Sarah Baker, what were your thoughts on the first two episodes of The Conners?
I felt the same way. I was nervous, but Laurie Metcalf and John Goodman are so incredible. And I think Sarah Gilbert has really turned out to be an interesting actress. And I think when I watched the first episode, I was like, it's kind of weird because her character was so, you know, so teenage and so misanthropic that to have that as sort of the center now seems weird. But the more I watched, sort of the less it bothered me. And she still sort of retains some of that while also being like a nice, normal mom. Mm-hmm. And I thought you just can't beat John Goodman and Laurie Metcalf. You know, Laurie Metcalf actually made me choke up in the first episode. And,
same.
Yeah. And also both of them made me laugh. John Goodman's line about, like, seeing a lot of action in Nam to that one, like, smart mouth kid actually made me laugh out loud. And then the second episode, yeah, I agree. It's like, okay, you can see how we're stepping away from the Roseanne stuff and how the show is sort of taking its own shape. And there's also, I think they're just handling all their people really well. Like, DJ is there, but we don't have to see a ton of DJ. little yeah. splashes. And I think his wife is actually really good. That actress is really good and funny and knows who her character is strongly. So I liked it. I think I'll keep watching. I mean, I wasn't like, you know, it's still a multicam format, which is not so much my jam, but I think I'll keep watching.
Now, after we watched the first two, I turned to Dave and said, I wish that they had started with the second one, because I felt like the first was very heavy. But Dave, you disagreed.
Yeah, I thought the first one actually did an okay job of, I mean, they had to address it, right? I don't think they could have just started, you know, it would be like Connor's 2025, you know, they just.
I mean, I thought they could have started like a year later, but go on.
I'm just being facetious, but.
Yeah.
It could have been worse, right? I mean, they could have went the other way. It was the day of the funeral and everybody's doing doing their remembrances that way.
Like on news radio.
3 weeks is such a weird time after a death in the family, right? Because, you know, the weird sort of saving grace of being so fucking busy with all the red tape of somebody dying, especially when it's just like your first parent and the other parent is still alive and you have to help them deal with all the stuff. Like, there's so much stuff that has to happen right away. And it's like a whirlwind. Like, when my dad died and I went up back to Canada, like, I had to stay up there for a month just to deal with changing the car registration, the bank stuff and the insurance stuff and phoning the OPP and figuring out where the pension stuff goes now and all this sort of stuff. Like, there's so much to do that, like, around the 2 or 3 week is like where you actually like get a moment to yourself. And I felt like the kind of the tone of the first episode did an okay job capturing that, just sort of like the exhaustion of being in the public, everybody saying how sorry they are and all that kind of stuff, and just doing all the grunt work of a family death. And then just like having this moment where you let yourself be yourself and let go and just like be sad for a while. I thought that was pretty good. The one thing I kind of like I know it was a storyline in Roseanne 2.0 with her pain management and stuff like that. But the whole opiate overdose thing seemed a little after schooly to me, like the way they handled it. Like, it seemed a little broad, you know, a little loud.
This is a good time to throw to Buncey, I think, because as an intervention chronicler, this is more her area. How did you think they handled it and or the bereavement, since that sadly is something that you also have gone through in your family very recently?
I thought they did. I think they had limited options, really. Like, they could have handled it sort of in the Charlie Sheen way, which was to literally drop a safe on her or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I don't think was an option. And, you know, I think they put in this, I think the way that they ended up going with it, at least in the first reboot episode, where it turns out that there's like a pill sharing ring, because healthcare in this country fucking sucks. And the fact that they tacked to the left with that, I thought was clever. But there were certain things that I think they had to do, and they did them. Mm-hmm. And I agree with Sarah Baker that, you know, having Laurie Metcalf in your cast to handle the parts that need to be sad, that on one level you have this cast saying goodbye to this character who was their center, but then you also have the character saying goodbye to the character. And she was such a champ in that scene, which is something you haven't really seen before, that trope of the, you know, frantically organizing person trying to control grief by rearranging the cabinets. Sure. But what I also liked about it is that there is a really black humor, or sometimes not even a black humor, around these events. Like, everyone's sort of coming and going in the house and, you know, passing the portrait of the person and sort of fondly patting it, but also still making fun of that person. Like, maybe that's just my family, but I thought that was very relatable. Like, Becky being like, you know, they find the pills and Dan takes them and she's like, that was the only thing from mom's closet I actually wanted. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, there you go. And then Dan at the bar being like, this is a domestic beer. My loss is deeper than that. Like, that is exactly something that my my late Uncle Cliff would have tried to pull. Just kidding. He didn't really like imported beer. He would have tried to leverage it somehow, though. May he rest. But yeah, I thought it was, I don't know that this is really my jam either to keep watching, but I thought this was the best parts of what I liked about the original from back in the day. And I have to say that Sarah Gilbert has gotten really good at these quick changes between, like, the fact that this character is always kind of up on a tightrope with the snarkiness, like, over the sadness. And she's gotten really good at changing back and forth between those really quickly and letting us see what the character is. And she had a really nice moment with that in the second episode. And I was impressed with it. Like, this is not something that I would, you know, seek out, but I'm not going to leave the room to avoid it, you know, on principle, thanks to its lead character's bullshit anymore. Yeah. So yay.
Yeah, that's what made me so sad about the first one. Like, the last season of Roseanne, that I thought the first episode that we saw was not very good. The second one was getting better. And then the third that they had provided for critics was, like, from later in the season. I think it was episode 7. And it was one that got into the character's opioid addiction. And that was, like, getting the closest, I thought, to what the original run of the show did so well, which was, like, actually portray the problems of working class people. And that was, like, the whole line about the reboot. Like, there are other shows about working class people. They're just not always white. Like, we get it. But I thought that was really strong. And so it's, you know, I get why that was a through line and it made sense for that to be the cause of her death. But, like, what made me so happy about the second one was, it's like, this is a show that I can enjoy, and it's bringing up another generation of characters too. I have to say, as good as Sarah Gilbert is, and she is, the casting of Emma Kenney as her daughter is amazing. Those two look so much alike and they have such nice chemistry, I thought, her and Harris.
And that actor really looks like the product of the other two actors. Mm-hmm. It's really amazing. I will also say, just quickly before we get off the topic of the opioid stuff, there's also a moment in the second episode where Becky is talking to Dan about how she was really having difficulty going a whole day.
Yeah.
Or a whole shift without drinking. And they managed to play, like, this is a really narrow fairway to stay on, that it's not a PSA, but it's not like inappropriately jokey either. Mm-hmm. It just is. And I think that has always been the gift of this show, that they could just let things be both, like, a little bit dark or scary, but also kind of funny, which is how they are in life. And it's always been good at that. So I appreciated that too. And I might actually tune in to see where that goes, because it's, like, the one show that I might, you know, be interested to see what they do with it, because there's kind of only two things that shows ever do with it. And I think they would find a third way. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, I also thought it was interesting that they sort of made it like that's part of her job as a waitress, that, you know, she drinks shots on the job. Like, that's related. I mean, I feel like that's a thing I've seen surfers do in life and on shows. Like, you know, that makes more sense. Whereas when you're working drywall at 6:30 in the morning, it's not really okay to come with a vodka bottle full of, or a water bottle full of vodka. But they also have her, when he says he has a zero tolerance policy about that on the job, and she shoots back like, oh, what does the union think about that? Which I thought was also a good line, that she could get him back. But anyway, Sarah Baker, do you think you will continue watching this, or was there more that you thought about the first two episodes that made you hopeful or not about the coming seasons?
I mean, I think I'll definitely tune in for the third and then see. I mean, my typical habit with a show like this where I like it, but I'm not necessarily, it'll end up sitting on my DVR and then mm-hmm. there'll be two and then there'll be three and then I'll either watch them all or delete them. So right. we'll see which way it goes. But I do think in talking about all the stuff with her death, they did kind of pick the perfect time for it to be, like, if it had been at the funeral, it would have had to be sad or would have been so mm-hmm. inappropriate. But yeah. we don't want to be that sad for that character.
Right.
So I thought it was,
yeah, that's a good point.
You know, super smart for them to put enough distance so that we wouldn't have to watch people mourning this, you know, terrible ish woman.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really clever. And I do think that's, It didn't bother me, the darkness of the first episode, just because I feel like that show was always, and maybe it's because of the time period it was on when they used to not just be joke, these multicams. Mm-hmm. But I thought they did allow moments to breathe on that show always. And
yeah.
And like you're talking about with the drinking thing, where it wasn't like, oh my God, she's a terrible alcoholic. And by the end of the episode, she's totally downhill. Nor was it just resolved. And now she doesn't drink anymore. It's like, yeah. No, this is going to be an ongoing thing. And even her dad isn't like, God damn it, Becky, you've got to get a handle on this thing. You know, it was just like,
right.
She was like, I'm going to try to do better. And he was like, okay, well, you know, I'll give you this much time. And there we go. You know,
mm-hmm.
everything is just a little bit more, yeah, realistic for a multicam show, which I appreciate.
I also like that they threw in a Lady Bird joke in the second episode, too, with Harris threatening to jump out of the car.
Oh, yeah.
For even if Laurie Metcalf couldn't be in it with her, it's still, I saw it and I enjoyed it. Well, Dave, I doubt you're going to keep watching this unless I do.
Yeah, I mean, it was good. I liked it. But yeah, I'm kind of with Sarah. Like, it's not appointment television for me, but I mm-hmm. thought they walked a line. I thought they did a good job with their situation. If anything's going to keep me from watching the show, it's probably DJ's hairline, which is terrifying and Munsterish. It's frightening. I don't know what DNA that guy's working with, but that hair is going to last him a lifetime. And you know, well done, I guess. All right, everybody, it is time to go around the dial talking about a little something we're watching these days. First stop, Tara Ariano.
Well, I wanted to compare and contrast the first season of Camping on HBO and the second season of Splitting Up Together on ABC, which has just started and which, full disclosure, includes on its writing staff Brian Rubenstein, my co-host on Bride and Doom. Hey, Brian. Camping is the new show from Lena Dunham and Jenny Connor, and I believe it's a remake of a British show. And this is the one with Jennifer Garner. She's married to David Tennant. It's his birthday. They go out camping with a bunch of their friends, and she's extremely type A and neurotic, and everything goes wrong, and she can't handle it because she's super type A. This is the less interesting of these two, and yet I'm going to keep watching it because, like, everything around the Jennifer Garner character is so good and really well observed. Sarah Baker's former co-star Brett Gelman is on it with his real life. Are they married? His wife, girlfriend, his partner.
It's complicated. Jinxa Bravo.
Okay. They play a couple on the show. They are great. Juliette Lewis, who also was guest starring in the second episode of The Connors that we saw, is a cast member here as well. Ione Skye plays Jennifer Garner's sister. Chris Sullivan from This Is Us is playing a much more scumbaggy character than he does on that one. All of them are great, but I feel like there's so much, they make the Jennifer Garner character, Catherine, the butt of the joke so often. And like the premise is not the premise of the show, but the premise of her character is that she's had problems with her pelvic floor. Like, she had to have a hysterectomy and an ovectomy after the birth of their son. And she's had like 10 years of chronic pain and issues with this. And they make it seem like all of her, like, it's all in her head. They make it seem completely psychosomatic, which is a really weird choice for a show from two women creators when, like, women living with chronic pain and that doesn't get diagnosed properly or taken seriously by doctors is a real problem that happens. And I believe Lena Dunham has had some kind of gynecological issue, like fibroids, maybe. I can't remember. But like, you would think that she would have more empathy for this character, but she's just so abused in a way that is not enjoyable. Like, I was sort of with her in the first episode where there's like she has a whole binder for this week that they're spending camping. She's planned things out like to the minute. And when they happen upon a lake, she's like, no, we can't go swimming today. Swimming is tomorrow. Today is for bird watching, and gets all, you know, angry when no one listens to her and stuff. Like, I'm also type A. I get it. But she's so joyless, and like it's just everything around her is great. And then for her to be the center of it is like just unfortunate. Whereas contrast that with Lena on Splitting Up Together. This is a show that we talked about briefly when it premiered at midseason earlier this year, where this is the couple, Jenna Fisher and Oliver Hudson, are getting divorced, but they can't sell their house because they're underwater. So the parents just take turns living in the big house and looking after the kids 1 week at a time. And Lena is also super type A, and we're given to understand that part of the problem with their marriage is that she sort of had to become like the naggy stick in the mud because someone had to do it in their marriage because they had three kids. And yet this show has so much more empathy for her. And the premiere in particular, which is the only one I've seen so far, the second episode will air tonight as we're recording this. They have her go on like this. She and Oliver Hudson's character are trying to like maybe rekindle things or try it out or just fool around or whatever. They're not sure what they're going to do. So she books them at this Airbnb in Malibu. And when they get there, it's not as advertised. Like, there's a hot tub, but it's like disgusting. They claim there's a king bed, and it's clearly not. And after she spends the night with like 1 foot on the floor because it's so small, she like waits for him to go for a run and then goes like ransacking the house looking for sheets and finds one that says full and calls to complain. And it was like, this is relatable to me. That's exactly what I would do. I would be furious and I would want to solve the problem. And so the way they get through it is like she has to explain to him, like, you know, I would appreciate you understanding like that there are reasons why I'm like this. And part of it is because you're not like this and someone has to be, or else things would not function. And so if you are interested in a type A female character, but want one that doesn't treat her like a joke all the time, I would recommend Splitting Up Together over Camping. Although I am going to keep watching Camping because the supporting characters are superb. And for my plug, Sarah and I were lucky enough to be back on Dave and Jeb Buncey. Aren't Mean. What? Buncey. Thank you, Dave. And I were welcomed back onto Dave and Jeb Aren't Mean. Past and surely future guest of ours, Jeb Lund, has a Hallmark, a podcast where he talks about movies of the Hallmark Network. And so we had previously been on in May, I think, to talk about The Wedding March with Josie Bassett and Jack Wagner. The Wedding March 2 is the obvious choice for us to discuss in that second episode, so we'll link it in the show notes, but that is now free. It's no longer behind a paywall, so check us out, ripping on Jack Wagner's weird Elizabeth Warren hair on that.
Sarah Baker, what do you got?
I have been watching Get Ready for It, especially after what I just said about multicam sitcoms, The Cool Kids on Fox, which is a show starring Martin Mull and David Alan Greer, Vicki Lawrence, and Leslie Jordan. The premise is that the three guys have been friends, and they had a fourth best friends, the cool kids, you know, the cool table in the retirement home. And one of their friends dies, and Vicki Lawrence comes in and sort of barges her way into their table and their friendship and lives. And they are all fast friends and go on adventures together. Guys, it's funny.
Really?
Love it. It's, I mean, okay.
I believe you. I'm just excited to have another show to watch. It's,
now, granted, again, I've said I'm not a big multicam person. So I go into a show like that thinking, man, I'm really excited because I love all four of the main people. Mm-hmm. But also, this could be so dumb and terrible. So the bar was low. So let's state that up front. But I mean, I laugh every episode. Leslie Jordan is so funny to me. I also watch Will and Grace, which I also very much enjoy. And it's a different character than he plays in Will and Grace. He's more what I would imagine the actor is like in person. He's just a regular guy. But you know, you haven't really seen an older gay guy character that much on television.
Yeah.
And while it's very much a part of his personality and, you know, he talks about dating and men and whatever, it's not like othered at all. You know, it's just part of who he is. But they're all buddies. They get into little adventures. It's, I mean, it's still very silly multicam in some ways, but, and maybe it's, you know, the background of those three people or four people. But it just kind of works for me. And Martin Mull is still Martin Mull. And he, you know, he's fairly subtle and his character is a little bit more of like the subversive kind of down note guy. And David Alan Grier is always really funny to me too. So I think it does a good job at it kind of reminds me of when I was a kid watching Golden Girls.
Okay.
I think this will maybe be that for some people because it comes on a Friday night too.
Yeah.
And for me, Golden Girls was on at an age where it was like maybe you would go out sometimes on a Friday night, but oftentimes you were at home, but you weren't going to bed early. You were old enough to, you know, stay up and watch TV. And there's just something very comforting about that. There's, you know, it's a multicam, so they're not in a lot of different places. It's kind of like Golden Girls in that respect, only the setting here is a nursing home. But it's just comforting. It's like a delicious bowl of soup. And I think you should check it out.
Well, I enjoy Mom. So that sounds like it would be a good pairing with Mom for me.
Yeah, totally.
And for your plug, you work all the time, but what is, tell us about the next thing that you have coming up.
The biggest thing I have coming up is a show called The Kaminsky Method, which will be on your Netflix machines on November 16th. It's 8 episodes. It stars Michael Douglas and Alan Arkin. I play Michael Douglas's daughter, Nancy Travis, who is on everything right now with her reboot. She plays Michael Douglas's student / love interest. And it's basically Michael Douglas is an actor who maybe had a brush with fame in the past, but isn't like a really super famous, well-known actor. But he has this very successful acting school that he runs. And I, as his daughter, sort of run mainly the business side of that. And then Alan Arkin plays his longtime best friend / agent. And Alan's character suffers a loss at the beginning of the series. And this kind of follows that, their relationship together. It's a good binge show. It literally, each episode, there's not a lot of time covered. Each episode picks up where the last one left off, more or less. So, and it's only 8 episodes, and Michael Douglas and Alan Arkin are incredible, and Alan Arkin is a freaking delight of a human being. So please watch.
I'm glad to know that. That sounds great. I will definitely watch that for sure. Yay.
Bunty.
I'm here to talk about Get a Room with Carson and Tom. I actually have not watched the new Queer Eye. I loved the original, though, and I love Carson Kressley as a judge on RuPaul's Drag Race. But I was a little apprehensive about this because Carson, at least, is sort of like, you know, those like little silver candy balls on Christmas cookies.
Yeah.
I was like, they're circles. They're balls. They're great, but like a handful of just those is no good. You need the cookie. So I was a little apprehensive because Carson could be kind of a lot. But I like Tom Felicia a lot, not least because he laughed at one of my jokes in an elevator once, like 15 years ago. And I was like, thanks, buddy. You didn't have to do that. So I thought, what the hell? It's not going to be reinventing the wheel, but I think these two will really balance each other. And it's probably TV comfort food. It is not reinventing the wheel. It is TV comfort food. These two clearly like are definitely friends in real life. They really like each other. the sort of conceit, at least in the beginning, is that Carson, and he is Chiron'd this way in several shots, is a interior design trainee. He really, like, he has one moment with an early client where he sort of freaks out that Tom is going to check his work and is not going to like it, and then that the client is not going to like it. He really is learning this aspect of the business, and then Tom is teaching him and us at the same time little tricks, like why things look way more orange once you get them home than they do in the store or at Mood, which of course they're at Mood. You know, again, it's something you haven't seen before. The episode structure is predictable. It's a couple of different clients during each episode with varying budgets and levels of neurosis. And there's plenty of time in there for Tom and Carson to do like bits in the car on their way to Scarsdale or wherever they're going. There's a little bit of helpful intel from Tom about how to set up spaces. There's behind the scenes insight into how to collaborate with reluctant / tacky clients. Do you need to DVR this when there's an entire HGTV network? Not necessarily. But if you let them rack up 5 or 6 weeks of episodes and then bunk down with a marathon of it on a weekend day when the weather gets cold, it'll be just the thing. And if you do want to watch live or live-ish, it's on Friday nights. So
I watched it too. I thought it was good as well. And I agree that the chemistry between Carson and Tom is delightful, but I felt like it didn't need to be an hour.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
Because
given that it's two clients each time, like just cut it down to half an hour. That was sort of, yeah, I agree with you. I hadn't thought of that, but yeah.
Because the thing is, like, for what they're filling with, it's like you're not going to be able to learn much that you can translate to your own room when you're dealing with a client where you tell them, for me to redo your living room and your deck will be $130,000. And they're just like, sure, like there's nothing I can take from this in my own life.
Well, that and then was, the other client is like, I have a budget of $5,000. Also, you will need to consult on your design decisions with the chandelier that is inhabited by the spirit of my dead mother-in-law.
Uh-huh. That room looked great though. I mean, they both did, but I thought Carson did a really nice job with that room. Yeah. But yeah, I agree. It is enjoyable. And it's like all of HGTV shows, even the ones that are now, like you just turn it on, like sort of pay attention to it and then just wait for the reveal at the end and you know, but you're good.
And everything looks so pretty and clean on those shows. I really love it that I'm like, if I only just like dusted and got a magic eraser after those smudges on doors, like I too could live like this, but instead I'm fucking watching TV as always. Anyway, that's Get a Room with Carson and Tom. It's Friday nights on Bravo. For my plug, I have a true crime podcast. It is called The Plotter Presents. Recently, I've begun publishing or recording little sort of shorties. They're called Plotter Briefs. Teehee. Nice. Briefs. I literally say teehee every time I say briefs. It's a thing. It's all the stuff that I don't get to on the main podcast. So this week, apparently we're in a golden age of football crime podcasts. So I'm talking about a couple of those. I'm talking about a couple library books I read. I'm talking about a couple episodes of POV. And then on the main podcast, Eve Beatty and I are getting into Making a Murderer and a super terrible and tacky take on the Bernardo Homolka case from 2006, starring, I shit you not, Laura Prepon.
Oh, I'm very aware.
And Misha Collins of Supernatural. Uh-huh. It's not good. So that's what we're talking about on the main podcast. But in the same feed, you have little 5 to 7 minute short shots, as it were.
Nice.
That's Blotter Briefs, Teehee Briefs, wherever fine podcasts are not sold.
So I actually watched something this week. So I actually have a real thing to report. I'll probably get back to people force Dave to watch other things next week. We were trying to find stuff to watch because we had a very lazy weekend here at Austin HQ. I came across, and I feel like in the back of my mind, I knew about this, but I had forgotten about it. There are two episodes of Monty Python that they filmed for the German market and actually made them in Bavaria, and they're on Netflix now. Under a separate bucket, it's Monty Python's, oh, my German is terrible.
Fliegender Zirkus.
Fliegender, yeah. Fliegender Zirkus.
Yep.
It's actually like, it's not essential, but it's actually pretty novel if you're a Monty Python fan and you haven't seen it, or you haven't seen it in a long time. It's like 65% new stuff, I'm going to peg it at, thereabouts.
The second episode had less new material than the first one, I think.
Yeah, and the first episode, the guys are actually speaking German and it's all subtitled. Apparently some of them are doing it phonetically. There are some like weird little twists, like the lumberjack sketches in it, but it's all in German. It's all in German. The guy's like a barbarian, you know, he's got the lederhosen and everything like that. but there are some good sketches, and there are some terrible long sketches that are like real clunkers, especially in the second episode. But if you're a Monty Python fan, it's worth checking out. They're like an hour and a little bit each, and it's just so weird to like see them speak German and like sketches that seem familiar, but they're all now German people. It's just like it's it's like stepping into like a fringe universe, you know. It's just like, what happened? Oh, you're in the German Monty Python universe now. It's like, okay, got it. So that's available on Netflix. Tara, once again, the title:
Monty Python Fliegender Circus.
Yes, there you go. And in other news, we actually ended up devouring the whole run of Dreamland/Utopia that Dan Cassino made me watch. That was very good. Yeah. There is actually another season that season three that's not on Netflix yet, but so that's something to look forward to. And then we moved on to Tara already watched it, the One Degree of Separation show Rosehaven, which you talked about, right? Earlier?
Yeah, I talked about it in Around the Dial, yeah. I think earlier this
Two year. Of the actors that are on Utopia also have the show called Rosehaven, set in Tasmania, sort of a quirky small town friendship series, and it is really funny. It is like
just the right amount of
quirk without being fey. It's perfectly done. I really enjoyed it a lot. So,
alas, yeah. You can't find it anywhere, but I might be able to help anyone who's planning to fly to Tasmania.
Through methods.
To locate it, because it's, I don't think it's on the Sundance Now app even, which is what Sundance aired.
But here's the thing. There are so many outlets that need material that I bet in 6 months it'll be somewhere.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, if Dreamland made it to Netflix, I'm sure it'll be on Netflix too at some point.
Exactly. Yeah. That means it is time for the canon, a user submission this week from Dylan Garcia. You may recognize that name. He wrote a lot for previously.tv. He is here to talk about RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars. Take it away, Dylan.
Hi, Extra Hot Great. I'm presenting Season 2, Episode 5 of RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars, titled Revenge of the Queens. This episode deserves a spot in the canon because of its Shakespearean vanquishing of seasoned villain Phoebe O'Hara, the hilarious main challenge, and most importantly, the greatest lip sync the show has ever seen and ever will see. We begin in the workroom with Phoebe O'Hara throwing a ludicrous amount of shade at the most recently eliminated queen, Alyssa Edwards, when it is dramatically revealed that all of the queens that have been eliminated so far in the season are seated behind the two-way makeup mirror, listening to the whole conversation. Phoebe stands in stunned silence while the other girls scream in confusion. The eliminated queens make their return to the workroom, and Alyssa immediately confronts Phoebe, who comes across as bitchy and petty, so nothing new.
Do you remember when you were in high school on the phone and you were like, girl, I can't stand her, she is so fake, and then your friend was like, well, Melissa, what do you think about that? And they were on three-way. Phoebe's crack was that three-way phone call in high school crack.
Rue enters the workroom to announce the challenge. An eliminated queen will be paired with a queen still in the running for a stand-up comedy routine. The top two returning queens will lip-sync for their life. The winner will eliminate a queen still in the running and return to the show in their place. A live audience for the show will be fellow drag queens, and everyone is beyond nervous. Alyssa is paired with Alaska, Ginger with Katya, Tatiana with Detox, Coco with Fifi, and Roxy will serve as solo MC. And if she wins, she gets to eliminate a queen and then choose a queen to return. Spoiler alert, she doesn't win and is terrible the entire season. Fifi and Coco reprising characters they played on their season, which is super lazy, probably because the two of them don't seem to have a sense of humor despite being drag queens. Coco knows she's not coming back and is visibly bored throughout the brainstorming session. Although Alaska eliminated Alyssa in the last episode, they work together well and plan on playing up Alyssa's bonkers one-liners. Alyssa does not know what cliff notes are, and also I'm pretty sure she doesn't know how to read.
You make an outline, I can go with it on the fly. Now I'm going to have my cliff notes. Cliff's notes. Like Cliff's? The person's name is Cliff.
Who told you that?
I read them. They're their books.
Yes, exactly.
The show begins with Roxy immediately apologizing and sucking and proceeds to fumble her first joke. She then makes a fat joke that turns to an airport joke and everyone groans at it. Like I said earlier, she's not going to win. Phoebe and Coco are out first, and holy shit, somebody call Tennessee Williams. Phoebe's character is pregnant in a pink miniskirt with blonde braids and 6-inch fingernails, and Coco is playing someone that looks embarrassed to be near Phoebe. They perform a weird, humorless one-act play with exactly one joke about using Doritos dust as makeup. It lasts only 1 minute, but oh my god, what a minute. Roxy returns to the stage as her character Tasha Salad from Season 5's Children's Show Challenge and proceeds to bomb some more with some hot salad puns. Why does she have this costume with her? Why is she doing this again? Oh god, why? Alaska and Alyssa come out and kill it in the most bizarre dialogue, roast, I don't know. It makes no sense and somehow absolutely destroys the room. It's proof that charisma can get you far in this show. Ginger and Katya are fine, and that's about it. Although it's more prepared than Alaska and Alyssa's bit, it comes across as forced and weird. Guess what, y'all? More salad puns from Roxy. Tatiana and Detox have a weird alliterative monologue about anuses, and it's weirdly the funniest act of the entire night. It's hard to describe, but it works on all levels.
Oh, you see, there's a bevy of beautiful bitter bitches already here hitting the buffet. B and I met last year at Patty's Pooches with Prolapse Garden Party. We did.
The rosebuds were in full bloom.
The assholes were out, literally.
Alyssa and Tatiana declared top, while Roxy and Fifi are on the bottom, which feels about right. Both could go home and nothing of value would be lost. What makes this episode especially canon-worthy is the lip-sync to the flawless Rihanna's Shut Up and Drive, and what proceeds for the next 104 seconds is stuff of legend. Each queen is a known lip-sync assassin, and are performing at the top of their game. It comes across as incredibly rehearsed because they respond and react to each other's moves, with synchronized jumps and spins and that thing where Tatiana points at Alyssa. It's honestly jaw-dropping, and Carson's reaction is so iconic and has been used in a trillion reaction GIFs on Twitter. In a win for the good guys, they both return to the competition and both eliminate Fifi with the biggest smiles on their faces. Fifi leaves the show looking like an even bigger monster when she refuses a hug from Alyssa, one of the all-time greatest reality show villains, I tell you what. I hope that you see the excellence in this episode that makes it so iconic and important in the history of the show. I hope it makes it into the canon, and if not, you're a bunch of homophobes. Sorry to break it to you.
Perfect. Well, Sarah Baker picked this from among our user submissions, so why don't you start us off with your thoughts?
Okay. I love the show. I've watched, I think, all episodes of this show, minus I think I missed like one whole season, which was maybe season 6. I have, I guess, a problem with All-Star seasons in general, mm-hmm. in that all the people that are on it should be the greatest people, but they've kind of now, because they're all also regular people, at least in this case, they have a drag persona that, you know, theoretically doesn't really change very much, but it's kind of like they figured out what people loved about them from the first season they were on that made them all-stars, and now they're mm-hmm. just doing a weird amped version of that. So that always kind of bugs me. It doesn't ever feel as genuine. I mean, Fifi, I know on these shows they're villains, but I am somebody who I'm not a love to hate it type person, I guess. And I just hate Fifi. She's so awful as a human being, and she wants redemption so badly, but she's not going at it in any kind of genuine way where she's actually going to get it, because she's yeah. not changed her insides. She's still the same person. Mm-hmm. And it just makes her look terrible. And so any episode where she's the main focus, I just can't get into. Plus, I feel like as an episode of this show, it just doesn't have any of the, to me, I would want it to be a classic episode. I want to see them all. There's no runway show, you know, there's no like normal runway walk, which is one of the best parts of the show. Not that every episode has this, but I would want it to be one of the ones where they're in the workroom putting their makeup on and end up talking about their lives. And even sometimes the people that are fighting on the show end up sort of supporting each other, because they have, in fact, all had mostly pretty hard upbringings, or at least shared some of similar hard moments in their upbringings because of being gay or because of being a drag queen, or in some cases because of being trans. And this episode didn't have any of that. I love Alyssa. I love Alaska. And so it has some queens on that I really like. But to me, this isn't like the classic RuPaul's Drag Race episode that I would want to add to the canon.
Okay. Bunsy.
Yeah, I have to agree. I would like to say, on behalf of homophobes named Sarah B, I guess, on this panel, I was definitely not mad to revisit this franchise. But I was struggling to see why this is canonical for the franchise. First of all, I can't agree enough with Baker about Fifi. It's not even satisfying when she's sent packing, because it's not like a comeuppance is ever received. She just Fifi's off, like she's gone, which is a relief, but it's not like she ever gets it. And before she's gone, she's an asshole. There was an extended opening argument in which the phrase thrown under the bus or some variation thereon, which is like one of the worst reality TV overuses as it is, was used like, I'm going to say conservatively 67 times.
That's
and,
fair.
And I couldn't even follow it. Like, in order to follow the beef there, I think you would have had to watch three episodes before it as well. You know, it's always a pleasure to see some of these guest judges. I love Todrick Hall. I love Chelsea Peretti. I love the editing that makes the comedic bombing seem even worse than it is. But the thing is, it was really bad. It was really painful. I laughed way harder at Dylan's Roxy shade than I laughed at anything anyone said, even the good routines. That three-way calling thing is the most I ever liked Roxy Andrews, but she gets a lot of screen time in this, and I don't like her either. So this, you know, this episode put me in the rare position of feeling kind of sorry for Michelle Visage. So that's unique, but I'm not sure it's canon worthy. And all of Baker's points are right on. Like, there are things about this episode that are not typical enough and give the show the heart and sweetness. And I continue to object to, at least in this season, the unbelievably baroque and unsatisfying elimination process with the lipsticks and the lip sync for your legacy. It's just too complicated. Everything about this is too complicated and not on brand enough in good ways. And like, the only thing that's really on brand is Fifi, and that's not a good thing. So I really enjoyed this presentation a lot. I did not hate watching the episode again, but I don't know. I don't see the logic.
Okay, I'll go next. I did love it. I agree with Dylan. It has so many iconic moments. I mean, You're That Girl I Knew You Were, an all-timer. The lip sync, he's right. It's like one of the greatest ever. And the coordination between them, like just from costumes onward, I assume that they had quite a colloquy like in the whatever time there is between, you know, their judging and when they come out, because they obviously worked out a bunch of stuff, like even in a rough way, and they sold it amazingly for me. I agree with Sarah Baker's points about, you know, that all-star seasons are not as satisfying. I agree with Bunsy that the judging is fricata, although I wasn't mad that both of them came back. But I was just delighted to revisit it again. I thought Dylan made a good argument, and it convinced me, although I have to say, pre-convinced, because by the end of it, when we get to like Fifi trudging off stage and Alyssa trying to hug her, and then like that hand wave, like so many gifable moments. I just love Alyssa. So For me, this was a great episode, and I personally do think it is canon worthy. So, Dave.
Okay, so Fifi as the villain totally works for me because she is just a total shit. Like, there is a moment where, like, I agree that it's a little unsatisfying at the end that she's not catapulted out of town, you know, out of the village kind of thing.
As far as we saw.
But that she is just like this total ass. And there is a moment where she tries to make up and mend the fence. But then, like, during that, she becomes incredibly defensive again and undoes everything she, like, had done in the past minute. And then she's put off by the whole process that she started trying to save her ass in the group. Like, it's amazing how self-destructive that she was in that episode.
That she's like, I don't have to kiss your ass to stay here. And Alyssa's like, but you do. That's what we're doing right now.
Right.
So do it.
Pig-headedness is sort of amazing thing, and when somebody is tossed for it, it is very satisfying. But, like, I agree, the manner in which she left at the end, like, there was no don't let the door hit you on the way out sort of moment from anybody else. Maybe because they had just experienced the return of a bunch of queens, so they were a little hesitant to make anything definite. But I did enjoy the episode. I'm not really up on, like, the structure and what, you know, goes into a typical episode of this show, even though we've talked about it a lot. We usually do season premieres, and I believe we did a canon that was two episodes before this, Once Upon a Time, judging by my iTunes library, which has episode three. Is this five? And then I think we did three at some point. But I really kind of enjoyed the premise that there is this, you know, comedy show and this MC and everything like that. I thought it was a good showcase, a la Snatch Game. I actually kind of felt sorry for the MC, because I feel like if that was me, I would be exactly the same. Like, I have stuff prepared, but I would fumble over it. Obviously, you guys know, if you've been listening to this podcast for more than 2 weeks.
You're a perfect angel.
Yeah. But the lip syncing at the end was fantastic, and you can really appreciate how the fans of the show really latched on to all the moments that Tara was talking about and Dylan was talking about that turned into sort of, you know, the internet memes and stuff with good reason. I did enjoy it. I just wish either that everybody else gave Fifi a nice send off, you know, or that Fifi was more blindsided by it, a la Mitchell from Survivor.
We were just talking about Mitchell,
a classic.
Yeah. If that was a little more satisfying, I think it would have been even better. But I did enjoy this episode a lot. So with that, shall we put this to the official vote?
Do you mean find out who the true LGBTQIA allies are?
All right. Baker.
Not the Americans. I'm
just kidding.
Every time somebody says Baker, I just imagine you in full desert camouflage running through some sort of action scene, because Baker is the perfect, you know, army grunt in a movie name. So Baker, what vote you?
I guess we've always already established that I'm a racist, so might as well throw homophobe onto the pile.
All right.
I vote no. I love the show. I vote no. Because I love this show.
Buncey?
Love the show. Love the presentation. Apparently don't love my LGBTQIA plus brethren, sistren, and otheren. It's a no for me.
All right, Ariane.
I vote yes.
All right. I'm also going to vote yes, but ties mean that, unfortunately, RuPaul's Drag Race All Stars Season 2 Episode 5 Revenge of the Queens, you are not inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for winner and loser of the week. Who has our winner?
Me. And it is Emerald Fennel, or possibly Fennel. I guess I've called the midwife, although I don't think she was on the most recent episode at all. Anyway, she's been cast in season 3 of The Crown, playing then Camilla Shand, the future Camilla Parker Bowles. And looking this up reminded me that I'd done a post that we'll link in the show notes on previously.tv that did side-by-side comparisons of a number of photos of Emerald Fennell and Khloe Kardashian because they have the same face. So if you can imagine that face with
it is
a weird...
uncanny.
It really is. I mean, partly that post, which you can see, as I said, in the show notes, you know, if I may say, good photo research, but still, they are really weirdly identical in the face. But anyway, that's going to be the other woman of Prince Charles' wedding in season 3 of The Crown, whenever we get it.
And loser of the...
Are you a show on Netflix consisting of a two-word phrase, each of which the words have four letters? Then you are shit out of luck. Or maybe your show is called Shit Luck. Iron Fist and Luke Cage were both canceled by Netflix after 2 seasons each. I forgot the existence of Iron Fist.
Yeah.
Never mind that it even had a second season, so that one's probably fine. Luke Cage is a little disappointing, I guess, but I think that show never quite figured out how to be best.
Yeah.
So
it was a real missed opportunity, that show. I wanted it to be so much better than it was. And it had like great moments, but it was so, that season was so flabby.
Yeah.
It was so long.
Speaking about things that are flabby and long, do you know what time it is? It's game time.
Oh, my 16th.
All right, everybody, this is the 6th game time of the current season. To remind you, the season scores are Tara 3, Buncey 1, and Value Guess also at 1. I just want to say at this point, if you have a game that you're thinking of submitting, please do so. Or if you just have an idea you want to pass by me first, make sure it hasn't been done in the past. Absolutely. Email me at david@cole, that's C-O-L-E. FYI, and we'll have a little chat.
All right.
So today we're getting into the upcoming Halloween spirit with a game called Monster Mash from our good friend Dan Casino. In this game, I'll give you the name and description of a monster from a TV show, along with the year the monster debuted. All you have to do is name the show that the monster appeared on. If you need a hint, I'll give you the name of one of the actors that appeared alongside the monster, or in a case of a cartoon, one of the voice actors.
Okay.
Here's an example. If I told you that Gossamer, who first appeared in 1946, is a giant orange creature apparently made entirely of fur with big eyes and tennis shoes who hangs around a mad scientist's lair, occasionally chasing rabbits, ducks, and pigs, you'd know that he appeared on...
Looney Tunes or Bugs Bunny?
Looney Tunes. And the hint would have been probably Mel Blanc. Make sense?
Nice. Yes.
All right.
Do we get 2 points for a correct answer before the hint and then 1 point after?
Well, yes, for the most part. And we'll get into that as we go along.
Okay.
To make things a touch easier, Mr. Dan Casino has ordered the questions chronologically by first appearance of the monster. So we're going to start in the distant past, work our way up to near present.
Okay.
There are 36 questions. Tara, steel mill situation, please.
Thank you, Dave. Sarah D. Bunting has 5 steel meals, and the valued guests have 3, and I have 0.
All right. Very good. And can you explain to Sarah Baker steel meals and how they work?
Absolutely. If another player craps out answering their question, you can, before Dave moves on or gives the correct answer, say steel meal, and then you can answer and steal their points.
Great.
All right, everybody, are we ready to play Monster Mash?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
All right, let's sort of pick and see who's going first.
We will start with Sarah.
So our order is Buncey, Tara, and then Sarah. Are we ready to play? Here we go. Our first round is the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And because the further back we go in time, I feel generally the harder this is going to be. I'm doing a few things here in this round. 1, free hints. So every question is worth 2 points and you get all the information. And 2, free steel meals. So if they don't get it right, get ready to steel meal. No penalty for it either. All right.
Wow. All right.
Here we go. Everybody's got 3 questions in this first round, 60s, 70s, and 80s, starting with Buncey. The Gremlin from 1963. A remarkably goofy-looking monster. This creature, who looks like a guy in a bad gorilla costume and some guy liner, it seems more curious than intentionally destructive. But the direction of Richard Donner made him threatening. Your hint, William Shatner.
Lynn?
Looks like a guy in a bad gorilla costume and some guy liner. He seems more curious and intentionally destructive.
The Twilight Zone.
The Twilight Zone, yes. The
Sarah! Famous
plane. Something. Yeah. Oh, the wing!
Unseen.
All right, this is Tara's first question.
Yep.
The Zanti, Z-A-N-T-I, 1963 okay. Also. Giant ant-like humanoid aliens who place their convicts on Earth. Their culture won't allow them to carry out executions, so they send them here, knowing that humanity will definitely wind up killing them. It's about halfway to a good Twilight Zone episode, which is right on par for this show. Your okay. hint, Bruce Dern.
The Honeymooners, just kidding. That's not my real answer. Is this The Outer Limits?
It is The Outer Limits. Halfway to a good Twilight Zone episode yep. is the perfect description of all of Outer Limits. Yeah. All right. Baker's first question coming up. Mugatu, a white gorilla with a horn on his head and a poisonous bite, existing on a very thin Vietnam metaphor planet. Your hint, Leonard Nimoy. What's that show?
I mean, Star Trek.
Yeah, that's a good hint for that
nice.
One. All right.
I think that's a real good hint.
Oh, it's
everybody's got their 2 points. Back to Sarah Bunting. Tybo, T-Y-B-O, not Tybo, like the exercise guy.
Oh, I remember that guy.
Tybo the Carrot Man. Let's pause for a moment. Tybo the Carrot Man. 1968. An alien represented by a guy in a carrot suit turned the entire crew of the Jupiter 2 into vegetable people in retaliation after Dr. Smith picked some flowers on his planet. Hint, Bill Mummy.
Moomy, I think.
Moomy, yes, you're right. Sorry.
And I think it's Billy.
Well, it says Bill here. You know, he's Bill now.
But I'm
back
sure that's
then,
true.
He was probably Billy. But now he's probably Bill. You want me to read that again for you?
Yeah.
All right,
yes,
we're talking
please.
About Tybo the Carrot Man.
As you
and
do.
This is a monster from 1968. An alien represented by a guy in a carrot suit, all right? Turned the entire crew of the Jupiter 2 into vegetable people in retaliation after Dr. Smith picked some flowers on his planet. Lots of hints there. So many hints.
Lost in space?
Yeah.
Space carrots. All right. Okay.
2 points there. Tara.
Yep.
The Ghost Werewolf from 1970.
Of course.
The green ghost of reported werewolf Silas Long. He shows up, scares people, and occasionally chases them down hallways. Turned out to be a sheep rustler in a mask. Your hint, Casey Kasem.
Scooby-Doo, where are you?
All right, everybody's doing well. Sarah Baker, geez. The Eltrusions. The Eltrusions, 1974. A benevolent race of highly evolved telepathic lizard people. The costumes didn't have moving mouths, so the telepathy was helpful. That created the mystical land our heroes are now trapped in. Your hint, Kathy Coleman. Kathy with a K.
Land of the Lost?
Land of the Lost. Well done. All right. Back to Buncey. Here's your last question of this round. The Spanish Mossman. 1974. A research experiment in dream deprivation produces a Cajun boogeyman covered in Spanish moss who goes on a murder spree until a reporter specializing in the supernatural figures out what's going on. Your hint, Darren McGavin. All right, I'm going to give you another hint here. This is the tough. I think this is the toughest one of this whole thing. Inspiration for the X-Files, this series was.
Does not help. Doesn't help. I'm afraid. No. Dark Shadows?
Steel Mill.
Steel Mill, Tara.
Kolchak the Night Stalker.
Kolchak the Night Stalker. Correct. All right. So Tara just picked up 1 point with that first free Steel Mill of this round. And here's Tara's real question. Your monster from 1976 Sasquatch. Sure, he looks like a Bigfoot, but he's actually controlled by aliens. You should get this. It's been on the show. And being used to steal precious metals and gems from Earth until he's stopped by a cyborg multiple times. Your hint, if you need it, Lee Majors.
The $6 million man.
The $6 million man is correct. All right.
Thank God for the hint, because I was very close to saying the Incredible Hulk.
Oh. All right, Sarah Baker, with our last question of this round. Your monster is the Arm from Jumping a Bit, 1989.
Ooh.
Yes. A being existing on a psychic plane that claims to have grown out of the severed arm of a human host. 25 years later, it evolved into a tree with a brain on it. Weird and unnerving, but that's kind of the point. Your hint, Kyle McLaughlin. Not yeah. McLaughlin.
Every time.
Twin Peaks.
The Kyle McLaughlin Group is my favorite show. All right. Score break, please.
Very, very close game. We have, I have 7 points. Sarah Baker has 6 points. Sarah D. Bunting has 4 points.
All right. Well done. We're now into round two. We're talking about the 90s monsters and the aughts monsters. And now you have to ask for the hint. All right. So two points if you can get it without a hint. You can guess. You get an incorrect guess, or you just, you know, you don't know it. Ask for the hint, after which the correct answer is worth 1 point. All right.
Got it.
Got it.
Starting with Buncey, your monster, Goldar, 1993. And giant ape with fangs and a blue face, wearing gold armor and a bizarre headdress. He's often big enough to wreck whole cities. And when he's not, he sometimes drives a giant robot. Either way, he's a chief antagonist in several seasons of the show he's on. Oh, and he has wings, too, because why not?
Benson.
I'll take that as a you need the hint.
Yes.
Your hint, Ricardo Medina Jr., who you might remember from that time he stabbed his roommate with a samurai sword.
Small wonder? I don't know.
It would have been so much better of a show if it was Small
Wonder.
It
really would have.
That is Power Rangers.
Oh.
All right. Tara, your monster from 1994 yep. is the Newark Flukeman. The human-sized flatworm created in a stew of irradiated sewage from Chernobyl. It attacks victims through the sewer system in Newark, leading to an FBI investigation.
I believe this is the X-Files.
Of course it is. X-Files for 2 points. Okay, the Bacchae, 1996. Innocent girls from ancient Greece are transformed by a demonic version of Dionysus into lesbian vampires. And no, the show in question was never known for subtlety. 1996. Ancient Greece. Lesbian vampires.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
That's incorrect. Here's your hint.
Damn it. Okay.
Your actor in question is Lucy Lawless.
Oh, Xena Warrior Princess?
That is good for 1 point. Well done.
Nice.
Oh, thank God.
Back to Buncey. The monster, Brain Guy. The year, 1997. A being from a planet of powerful psychics who claims to have no physical body despite the fact that we can see him. He also claims to have immense psychic abilities, but mostly seems to use them to teleport bad movies to a satellite. Brain Guy.
MST3K?
Yes.
Nice.
Well done. 2 points.
Wow.
Tara Ariano.
Yes.
The Wormulon Queen, 1999. A giant slug that anally secretes a highly addictive substance used in soft drinks in the future.
Futurama.
Futurama.
Damn it.
Yeah. But I think this is a good one for you, Sarah. The Gentleman, 1999. A group of floating ghouls who take away the voice of their victims so they can torture them to death without anyone being alerted. They are apparently still vulnerable to wooden stakes, though.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
Yeah!
Yay!
That's the way you
Second
do it.
Second time's the charm, as they say.
Buncey, the Man in Black... 2004. He was once a normal man with dark hair and steely eyes, but an encounter with the heart of the island brought by his brother Jacob changed him into a violent cloud of black smoke.
I was really hoping you were going somewhere else with that, but that's the man in brown. This is from Lost.
That's good for 2 points. Tara.
Yes.
Weeping Angels 2007. A race of aliens who disguise themselves as funerary statues of angels and only move when you're not looking.
Doctor Who.
Doctor Who. Sarah Baker. The Maenad. The Maenad 2008. Normally a human woman in appearance, the Maenad can transform into a clawed, bull-like creature who can manipulate humans. In one appearance, she forced an entire town into an impromptu striptease. In another, she turned a whole town into pigs.
I believe it's Maenad, M-A-E-N-A-D.
Well, I looked it up. This is apparently pronounced Maenad, but...
Like. Okay, sorry.
If we don't get the pronunciation right, there's no way.
This is the asterisk.
Kidding. I'll never guess it. What's a clue, please?
Anna Paquin.
Oh, I was going to guess that. True Blood?
Oh, you should guess it. There's no penalty for guessing.
Yeah, guess. I guess I don't watch that show, so I don't know what happens on it.
Believe in yourself. It is
Thank
True
you.
Blood.
That's my lesson.
Good for 1 point.
I lost a point, but I learned a lesson, guys.
All right, everybody's last aughts monster coming at you.
Okay.
The Rugaru, 2008. While they look human for 30 years, Rugaru develop an overwhelming desire for human flesh, and once they partake, they are transformed into savage, pale-skinned monsters.
Well, this one's Benson, obviously. Hint.
Your hint is Jared Padalecki.
So many Supernatural references lately. Supernatural.
That's good for a point. Tara?
Yes.
Your monster, Doomsday 2009. An alien monster with gray skin, red eyes, and bony protrusions all over his body. He is disguised as a normal human most of the time, his monstrous side only coming out when he's angry or exposed to certain alien rocks.
2009?
Yes.
Oh, so it's not Smallville. Is this The Flash?
Your hint, okay. Tom Welling.
It is Smallville.
It is. First monster appearance.
That fucker was on for a long time. Yeah. Damn.
Good for one point. Okay. All right. Our last question of this round. Doppelgangers 2009. When the first supernatural beings became immortal, they violated the law that all creatures must die. So the doppelgangers, who look exactly like them, came to existence to die in their place. Kind of like Kenny from early South Park.
Hint, please.
Nina Dobrev?
Dobrev.
The Vampire Diaries?
Correct. Also would have accepted the originals. And that is our second round.
Okay. Still very close. Sarah Bunting has 9. Sarah Baker has 11. I have 14.
All right. Here we go. Round 3. We're talking about the teens now. 2 points. 1 point after the hint. Starting with Buncey. Marceline the Vampire Queen 2010. All right. A fun-loving 1,000-year-old vampire queen. She does not need to drink blood to survive. Rather, she eats the color red. Marceline is also an avid musician who plays an electric bass that she made from her family's heirloom battle axe.
She sounds annoying, actually.
I assume shows aren't in here more than once, by the way?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
Okay. Because I would have guessed the original, so I need a hint.
Cloris Leachman. Fun-loving, 1,000-year-old vampire queen.
Right. Shit. I don't know. I don't know this one. Someone should steel mail this.
Anybody?
No.
This says Adventure Time. Adventure Time. Tara.
Yes.
The Infatata 2011. Okay. The undead Frankenbaby creation of Dr. Charles Montgomery, who tried to bring his baby back to life and accidentally reanimated a monster, haunts the basement of a haunted house.
Whomst among us? American Horror Story.
Correct. Sarah J. Baker, you, Jean.
Nope.
All right, that's the letter U, and then another name, Jean, G-E-N-E, 2011. Pharmaceutical experiments render a man invisible as he automatically camouflages himself so he can blend in perfectly with whatever background he stands against. In an effort to be seen, the man kills innocent victims and drains them of their pigment, leaving them ghostly white. What's that show?
That sounds cool. Hint me.
Joshua Jackson is your hint. And I'm going to give you another hint. Is? It's not Dawson's Creek.
I'm stupid. Not that stupid. I know he's on a show.
Yep.
A
show called...
The Leftovers?
Steel Meal.
Yep.
Fringe.
Fringe for 1 point.
Right. I was like, The Affair?
Damn, I should have started watching that shit.
All right, Buncey. Death's Head Manticore. The Death's Head Manticore, 2013. Manticores are highly aggressive and extremely venomous scorpion-like insects from the continent of Issos, which can grow as large as lobsters. Wow. And have markings on their tail that look like a human face.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Black Mirror?
I love that guess.
Amelia Clark is your hint. Amelia Clark. Is that her name? Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Game of Thrones?
Yeah. Highly aggressive scorpion creatures with human faces on their tails. Game of Thrones. Okay.
Calm down, Game of Thrones.
The Nogisuni, 2014. Nogisuni, an evil spot fox spirit which can take over a person, corpse, or even a werewolf, causing chaos and feeding off negative emotions.
The even a werewolf part makes me think this is Teen Wolf.
It is. Yeah. All right, Sarah Baker. Oh boy, I forgot this one was in here. All right, it's German. Fuck me. All right.
Vegan circus.
Gnacus Esser. And I got to spell that for you. G-E-D-A-C-H-T-N-I-S. Gnacus Esser. Generally looking like a normal human, this creature can turn into an octopus-faced humanoid that uses tentacles to burrow into a victim's brain and extract memories. Like most of the creatures in this series, the name is German. No shit.
Benson.
All right. Your hint, if it's going to help you at all, is David
Gentoli.
Gentoli?
Oh.
Gentoli.
Yeah. All right, fine.
Oh, wait. Okay, I was just listening to this really good podcast called the Extra Hot Great Podcast, and they were talking about stupid road rules guy.
Yeah.
And he was on another show, but it wasn't Road Rules, but that's what stuck in my head because I also watch Road Rules.
Like most of the creatures in the series, the name
Zoo?
Is German.
Oh.
No. Damn it.
Steel Meal.
Steel Meal.
Grimm.
Grimm for 1 point. And thank God the German show is over with. That made me sad. Buncey.
Yeah.
Grodd. 2015. A giant, super strong, telepathic silverback gorilla.
Yep.
He was temporarily relocated to Gorilla City on Earth 2 with the other intelligent gorillas, but has returned to Earth 1 multiple times.
Zoo?
Zoo is a much better show in your guys' imagination than it actually was.
They're just animals. They're not monsters.
Hint, Grant Gustin.
The Flash?
Yep.
What the fuck? The Flash?
Grodd, the telepathic giant silverback gorilla. We hardly knew
you. I think he might be Clancy Brown. Yes.
2016, the Demogorgon, an other dimensional creature named after a monster from Dungeons and Dragons with a face like a tooth flower opening and enormous strength.
Stranger Things.
Stranger Things, sure. Sarah Baker, the Kadarian Demon, 2016. An ancient demonic Sumerian spirit bonded to the evil book known as the Necronomicon. Portion of his essence can possess individuals, animals, or even in one memorable case, the severed hand of a main character. It is immortal, enormously powerful, but also seemingly vulnerable to a guy with a chainsaw.
Evil Dead?
That's close enough. All right, I'll give you that. That's what Ash versus called? The Evil Dead.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, that's close enough.
I only know the movie.
We're good here. That was Bruce Campbell, of course. Bunsy, Connie, the Hormone Monstress, 2017. Another dimensional creature who follows an adolescent girl around and encourages her to embrace her wildest desires.
Oh, we just talked about this. Yay, us. Now I can't remember the name of the show. What's the problem?
Yes, you can.
Oh my god, I could like draw the people from Big Mouth.
Yes.
Oh Jesus.
Now you've earned yourself a bubble bath.
Yeah, I did.
Tara, 2017, Bilquis, an ancient fertility goddess who survives in the modern day by consuming men after having her way with them, although not in the way you might expect.
American Gods.
American Gods, correct. All right, Sarah Baker. The Shadow King, 2017. A psychic parasite that moves in between the minds of various individuals, leading to symptoms of mental illness in his hosts. He prefers colonizing those with mental powers, sometimes appearing as a pallid, obese man.
Legion?
Legion.
Nice.
All right.
Everybody's last question coming at you, so let's get a quick score break, please, Tara.
Okay. Let's see. Sarah D. Bunting has 14 points. Sarah L. Baker has 15 points. I have 23.
Oh, okay. All right. Sarah Bunting, otherwise known as Buncy, the Griffin, 2018. A giant winged humanoid with feline legs who lives in a cliffside nest along the edge of the world. The characters assume she's male, but she corrects them and lets them know that gender is a spectrum. And I gave you another hint. We've watched this show, but I don't think any of us made it to this.
No, definitely not.
Happy endings? Just kidding. I need a hint.
Abby Jacobson. Abby Jacobson.
Broad City.
That
Steel
is.
Meal. Oh.
I think you're either out or you probably shouldn't be using them at this point.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
Okay.
If you just want to show off, please go ahead.
No, I don't.
Yes, you do.
Okay, I won't count my. I won't point myself, but it's disenchantment.
It's disenchantment. Yes, correct. Tara Ariano, 2018, the Tuunbaak, Tuunbaak, a massive creature resembling a polar bear with eyes that look almost human that rip apart British sailors stranded in the Arctic. Will Dave like it? Yeah, kind of.
What was this called? The Terror.
The Terror, correct. All right, last monster of the game for Sarah Baker. Your monster's name is unnamed giant gold flying robot monkey that poops missiles, 2018. Created by the toy maker, the fleet of giant gold monkeys that invades National City includes one extra giant one who poops missiles at our heroine.
Heroine is a good hint.
Sure.
Supergirl?
Supergirl, 2 points. Great way to end it. Let's get the final scores.
Okay, well, I realized that I was taking steel meals into past the free steel meal round, so I subtracted 5 points from my score because I don't know how many it was. All but right. Here we are. Sarah D. Bunting has 14 points. Sarah Baker has 17 points. And let's say I have 20.
Okay, so Tara takes it, but we're going to reuse our tiebreaker for some steel meal opportunities.
Okay.
All right. So here's your chance
because
to refill.
Because of my accidental cheating, I will sit out this round.
All right. That's fair. I'm going to allow that. So this is how it's going to work. I have 1, 2, 3, 5, 6 monsters that are all from the same show. First person to identify the show wins Steel Meals. And I'm going to take, I'm going to start at 6. I'm going to read the first one, blah, 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 all the way down. All right.
Gotcha.
Sooner you answer, the more Steel Meals you will get. Are you ready,
is this
Sarah?
A yell it out situation?
Yell it out whenever you want. Okay. And yell out as much as you want. Here we go. Finn the Golem. Finn the Golem, a hot guy created by a wizard to lure women into his lair, the Hollow, a cloud that can possess people, including hot guys, making them do things that are out of character. Finn the Golem. Number 2, Darklighters. Demonic spirits mostly portrayed by hot guys who try and corrupt magic users and the angelic...
Charmed.
Charmed is correct. That gives you 5 steel meals. 5 steel meals.
Damn, Sarah, you got 10.
Done. The coffer is full.
If only I ever knew anything.
Tara.
Well played, Tara.
Thanks.
Good job.
Other than the accidental cheating.
Oops. Yeah. We OD'd on the Connors before going around the dial, where we did some camping before splitting up together. We met the cool kids. We were told to get a room with Carson and Tom. And we finally joined the German episodes of Monty Python's Flying Circus. Dylan fucked it up, it being the induction of RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars episode Revenge of the Queen into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time, putting her within reach of the season win next week. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Reese,
Sarah D. Bunting,
do you ever read anything anyone wants to hear?
And Sarah Baker,
I'm a racist homophobe. Guess I'm Trump.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Not Great.
Stop!
What?
I don't know. I didn't expect the stop to work. So.
Gedächtnis.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.